Greetings to all.
I'm going to begin the presentation with the chronological context of how everything developed as far as I see it. And this is one of the few trials where I'm present here that I wasn't present, and I have to do the same as you do, and that's look in retrospect at a historical incident and antecedent as opposed to being there in living color in real time, so to speak. We begin with a bear, and I'm going to concede at the beginning that if my only proposition seeking reversal were to establish plain error based upon having a stuffed bear sitting with a child on her lap up near her face being embraced, held, whatever the terms of art may be, I would have to say I'm going to lose. I only point that out as part of the totality of the circumstances in considering whether or not this man's rights were abridged by everything that happened to him. And it began at the moment that the child prated in front of the jury. And I would have you note that some of our Superior Court trial judges in cases such as this will have the child seated in the witness box before the jury even comes in because of the spectacle of a diminutive child walking scarily across a courtroom with her hand held by somebody from the Attorney General's office or whoever is assisting her in. So one can only imagine the initial gut reaction that that jury experienced in watching this child walk in the courtroom carrying that stuffed animal before she ever uttered a single word. Can I say under plain error it was the game changer? No, I cannot. Can I say that there is a reasonable probability that it had a certain flavoring of the jury's receptiveness to her subsequent testimony? I can say definitely so and can't calibrate it any further.
Well, what does that mean, Mr. Hurley? Are you abandoning the plain error argument?
No, I'm not abandoning it. I'm just saying that that is more of icing rather than cake. I'm not throwing it away. I'm not dismissing it. It gives a flavor, but it is not the ultimate determinant on what should happen in this
not
case.
Not your lead argument.
That is correct.
What is?
My lead argument is twofold. That is the 3507 issue and the mistrial issue. And I go now to the 3507 issue because that's what next happened chronologically. The papers that we have submitted are rife with what happened, and I'm not going to go into detail except to say that the sum and substance of what that child said in court was limited to three remarks, and that is that something bad happened to her and that she didn't like it. And, of course, I've misplaced the paper, and it was wrong. That was it. The state asked a total of 12 questions that had to deal with even the surrounding circumstances. Where were you? It is not accidental that the state did not go beyond those 12 questions. In the CAC interview, we know that those people are accustomed to dealing with children, and they have devices so that they can communicate. They have dolls, they have drawings, and, well, those are the two things that they utilize. The prosecution has that same ability if they want to. If a child is having difficulty saying where she has touched parts, hand her a doll. They've prepped her the day before. They've established a rapport that the defense attorney doesn't have. Yet there is no incentive for the prosecution to do this in this state because they know that they will profit by simply a base question. What happened? Something bad happened to you. I don't want to talk about it. Okay, it's 3507 time. Sit down and watch a 44-minute spectacle of what has been said in the past and leave it up to the defense attorney to wander where no man wants to go, and that is being an adult talking to a child in an unfamiliar setting where he is associated with the hostile force and having to pull out what that child does not want to discuss, appearing to be a bully when she starts to break down and cry, and I've been there, done that. You're the bad guy, and you start to basically back away and flinch because you know you are pushing the wrong buttons in front of the jury. All of that is made easy for the prosecution because they don't have to do the labor that has to be done. And I simply say that the metric that should be put out for the prosecution is you at least are going to have a good faith effort toward developing the basic elements. When the person says my part, do a little bit more. Can you show me on the doll? Do you know a word for it? Here's a diagram. Can you point to it? It's very simple. It's not difficult. It's not clever. It's just not done because they don't have to do it. The case law does suggest without, and it was in the context of timing, the timing of the statement should not be done in such a way as to burden the other party. Well, if the timing should not be done to burden the other party, the entire way that the matter is protocoled should not be done as to burden the other party. And with the state having to put forth what I have called the skinny foundation, as they do, and you all have indicated that you took Blake and Stevens and Woodland together because this issue is coming up all the time, this 3507 foundational issue. I suggest that at least there's an objective standard. State, make a good faith effort to approach each of the elements that are required. That is all you have to do. And if the person says, I don't want to talk about it because it's nasty, so be it. But at least there has been touching upon, not just where were you, what happened, how many times, bye, see you.
Would we have to overrule Woodland?
No. Woodland was a plain error analysis. And actually, although you did approve the trial judge's decision with the dicta, he was only presented with the voluntariness issue, not with regard to the foundational issue. The language of the decision was somewhat broad and seemed to approve that, but that was a plain error analysis. This is an abuse of discretion analysis. So you can distinguish it on that basis rather easily and clarify it for future generations to come. With regard to the next issue, my next main issue, as Justice Jacobs asked, it is the issue of the statement made, the unsolicited statement made by Sylvia. And how I see this happening is, and I do lay the responsibility at the doorstep of the court, because of the failure of the court to realize that we are at a very critical juncture. Yeah, it's 4:40 in the afternoon, but it's going to be too late. The smoke is coming out of the house, the building now. We don't have the luxury of saying, let's go home for the night, go have dinner, and we'll come back and deal with the fire tomorrow. By then, the house is burned down. And then counsel is placed in a position of having to craft an instruction a day later, after the bell has been rung, to unring it, after the sight has been seen, to unsee it, which is impossible. So then the state can say, oh, he waived it. Yeah, he waived it because under the circumstances he didn't have a chance to get a contemporaneous instruction. I acknowledge that in order for there to be a proper mistrial declared, there has to be no other reasonable, practical alternative. At 4:45 in the afternoon, at 4:50, 4:55, at 5 after 5, Judge Ridgely has kept juries down here after 5 o'clock, I've witnessed myself, there would have been the possibility of doing something other than a mistrial.
Parking's free down here, Mr. Hurley.
Today it is. Who knows tomorrow? Had there been that attempt to do something at that point, we wouldn't be in a position of saying there was no other alternative. As it turned out, however, the lack of speed in dealing with the issue is what caused the problem. You were kind enough to let me submit decisions on the instruction aspect of prior rulings, and I went through every Delaware case with regard to curative instructions, and I think my number is correct. Before 2008, the words that were used by this court is ordinarily, one time, usually, eight times, normally, twice, the general rule, once. That was to describe how curative instructions can cure error. But it was always in the context of these words, swift, once, immediately, seven, immediate, once, prompt, three times, immediate and thorough, once, immediate and forceful, once. That was the context. But then there was a change. In Penna, in 2008, a very key word was put in that had never been put in the general, ordinarily, normal, usually, and that was the word prompt. Penna said there is a presumption that prompt instructions will cure error, and that formula, what I will call the Penna formula of promptness, was articulated 9 additional times. Every case since Penna in 2008 where you have dictated or authorized or approved the validation of curative instructions has had the word prompt as a modifier. Prompt ain't 24 hours later. In this particular case, at 4:40, the fire alarm had rung. And judge, the trial judge at that point indicated that he had had concern, but yet it was just deferred until the next day. It would have been so, so easy, and I guess it's always easy in retrospect and hindsight, so, so easy to say, take the jury out, as has been done in other cases where there's obviously a problem, but that wasn't done. Consequently, the task that the trial counsel had the next morning of making the decision, and you can see him equivocate, he's saying to the judge, what should I do, essentially, there was no practical and meaningful way to avoid a mistrial because there was no way to articulate to the jury, hey, remember yesterday where the witness testified that he'd done the same thing to another family member? Ignore it. Impossible.
Could you clarify for me at the late afternoon, the 4:40, right after the comment was made, was there a request for a curative instruction or a mistrial at that point?
At that point, a sidebar was approached. At that point, the trial counsel went up the sidebar and made an application. I know that the application was based upon the remarks that had been made about four questions and answers earlier. I'm not sure if he said, I move for a mistrial per se, but he evidenced that he had a problem with what was said, and at that point, the trial judge just said, okay, it's 4:40 in the afternoon, and we're just going to let the jury go home. So there was a clear sidebar approach. We have a problem here. I don't know that he used the magic words. I'm asking for a mistrial at this point. I think so, but I'm not positive of that. But clearly, it was on the table. We have an issue. We should deal with it, and brought promptly to the court's attention. Now, the remark itself. There's a Baker case, and this probably characterizes my position better than anything that I could say, and I don't recall who the author of the opinion was, but obviously it was brilliant in Baker versus State. Fewer things are more damaging to a defendant's case and credibility, particularly in a he said, she said, rape and child sexual abuse case, than a lingering, unfounded question that raises gets issues and permits the jury to draw an impermissible conduct from character inference that is entirely unjustified. And that's a question. Well, if that question in that case it was, are you familiar with sexual crimes, I think it was. Are you familiar with them? In this case, this was beyond familiarity. He did it not to just anybody, not the it being something. He did the same thing to my niece. One of her nieces was the defendant's daughter. The other niece was a child, female child. It don't get no worse than that, to use language that some of my clients speak in. And that, no one can say that that is not an unfairly prejudicial remark that has a diluting and contaminating effect on the fairness of that trial and the way that he would be viewed by the jury. Getz tells us about it. Baker tells us about it. Reed tells us about it. And Reed, somebody said, oh, it was already out there. He'd done something. And that was found, of course, to be totally inappropriate and prejudicial. And I suggest that no one can meaningfully argue, not even my esteemed colleague, that, oh, that's not that big a deal. That wasn't prejudicial to the defendant. And certainly the jury is not going to have any adverse inference against him or presumption against him because he has done the same thing to another member of his family. The interpreter issue. The state offers an obstacle that I can't overcome. I can't show prejudice. But what I can show is that this court has remarked in Guy versus State that when you talk about a plain error analysis, that one of the things that can be considered aside from demonstrating the substantial injustice is an assault, my word, on the integrity of the system. It is harder to imagine what can offend the integrity of the system of the courts when a requirement is put out, not could be, not recommended, it is a mandate. You shall swear interpreters, and it is ignored. And then we have a situation where that interpreter plays a key role in a trial itself by interpreting Sylvia's remarks, and that's the remark that came out that has been the explosive, the IED in this particular case. And interestingly, and I didn't catch this until my most recent preparation after my failed effort in my original brief, also, she says something very compelling in the 3507 statement And your decision in Diaz puts the same standard on qualifying an interpreter who interprets out-of-court statements that later come in under 11 Delaware Code Section 3507 as you do trial testimony interpreters, and that is to be properly qualified. And she made the remark that the girl didn't know the English word for vagina. So without that remark, we have part, parts, part, didn't like it, nasty, or whatever it may be wrong. We throw that remark in made by the interpreter, who we don't know who she was. She's not even identified. She's sitting out there somewhere in TV land, video land. And she makes a remark which gives the direct inference that the child is talking about a vagina. And I suggest that it does affect the integrity of the system. Can I prove that she misinterpreted something? No. An impossible task for me. If we had an interpreter or they had an interpreter there, I guess they could have done it at that point. I guess if we knew if the defendant spoke English, he could be tugging at his attorney's arm in the middle of examination and cross-examination and disrupting his train of thought. But we don't know that. We can't prove it. But we can prove it is detrimental to the fair administration of justice when you have the specter of somebody who is unqualified, or we don't know if they're qualified, playing an extraordinarily vital role in the administration of justice. And lastly, I go to the point of the sufficiency of the evidence. I have talked about what we call a generic case, I guess it's case, of proving rape, and this court has adopted three standards. There has to be specificity with regard to the nature of the acts. There has to be specificity with the number of times. There has to be specificity with regard to the time frame. In this particular case, 0, 0, and 0 was offered with regard to the number of times. The state arbitrarily chose 2, thanked them for their mercy. They probably could have chose 7 and been the same place that they are. There is absolutely nothing to support anything more than one count, and there is precious little to support anything for one count. Was there some kind of offensive touching? Yes. For all we know, based upon that record, he washed her vaginal area too harshly when he's given her a shower. What she has said is totally susceptible of that interpretation. Parts in that CAC interview, the parts are discussed. What are your private parts? Boobies? But I'm using words that the kids typically use, pee-pee, wee-wee, whatever they use. There's not just one part. There's 3 parts that these people discuss in the CAC interview. Was she talking about her vaginal area? We can speculate. The jury did. And they did because there was licking. And, of course, if it's licking, it has to be the vaginal area. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's not true. Or was it boobies? Or was it the butt? There's no way of knowing. It's guesswork for you. If you, as intelligent as you all obviously are, can't answer that question, how can 12 laymen? That's my presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll address the 5 arguments in the order that they appear in the brief. The first argument concerns whether or not there was a sufficient foundation for admission of a prior out-of-court statement of the child complaining witness pursuant to the statute, Section 3507 of Title 11. The state's position is that there was no abuse of discretion, that at the time of trial, the complaining witness was approximately 9.5 years old. During her direct examination by the prosecutor, she touched upon the prior recorded statement that had been made at the Center for Child Advocacy. It was a videotaped statement that was later played for the court, and it's in evidence. It's Court Exhibit Number 1. After the last argument, I made a point of getting a copy of it and watching what was actually on the CAC videotaped interview. She described the events in the statement and confirmed that her prior recorded statement to Diane Klecken, who was the CAC interviewer, was both voluntary and truthful. The complaining witness indicated that she had been assaulted at the home of her aunt, Janet, by her uncle, that is the accused, Sergio Gomez, when she was 5 years old. She said, quote, "My auntie's husband did something wrong to me and I didn't like it." At that point, the defense counsel objected initially to the foundation for this March 2009 recorded CAC interview. And the argument that was made at sidebar was that there was an insufficient touching upon the events. That was the nature of the defense objection. The trial judge permitted further examination, further direct examination of the child. The child at that point indicated that she had talked to Ms. Diane, is how she referred to Ms. Kleckham, about her uncle touching, quote, "my private part," close quote. And the state submits that that was certainly a sufficient enough touching upon the events in order to permit the prior out-of-court statement to be admitted under 3507. In Woodland, the complaining witness was a little bit younger. She was 7 years old, I think, at time of trial. And her testimony was that the accused had done something wrong to me, and it's nasty. With these children, you're not going to usually get any great detail, and this is not an unusual case where she describes
it. Arguing that there should at least be an effort in each case. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I don't know there's anything wrong with it, but the case law and the statute itself don't require that. What it requires is some sort of touching upon the events and an indication that the prior statement was both voluntary and truthful. That's what Keyes and Hatcher and some of the subsequent cases since the statute say. The statute's been in existence now for, I guess, 41 years. I think it was passed in 1970. And that's the foundational requirement. The concern has always been not so much with foundational requirements, but the right of cross-examination. And here the complaining witness is present in court and certainly subject to cross-examination. That's the constitutional guarantee.
Well, Mr. Hurley makes the point that to have to draw out facts from a young girl on the witness stand as the defense attorney in your cross-examination is problematic because it makes everything that comes out appear to be connected to the defense. It's the defense counsel who elicits that information, and that we have held that the timing of the introduction of the statement can't be set up in such a way that the defense has to come in afterward and be disadvantaged by it. Why shouldn't there be an equivalent requirement that the state has to go to, you know, reasonable efforts beyond just, you know, did you ever give a statement and generally what was it about, but in terms of the kinds of follow-up questions about details that would otherwise have to be drawn out by the defense counsel?
Well, I think the details in this particular case, at least, come out during the CAC interview, and the timing issue has been when the 3507 statement is placed in, that you have the child lays the foundation, in this case it was a child victim, then the other person comes in, usually the interviewer, a police officer, in this case Ms. Kleckham. She testifies that this is in fact an accurate statement, and no, at that point everything's laid and then the statement's played.
I understand that that's the way it works.
Right.
What I'm suggesting is that perhaps it would be more appropriate if the state, before it gets to play the tape, has to go to some greater effort to elicit from the witness the facts that are going to be heard on the tape. so as not to put the burden on defense counsel to go into some of those subjects and therefore make it something of a lack of a level playing field, if you will.
Well, I think the problem is usually not that an attempt isn't made. The difficulty is normally with these child victims and sometimes with adult sexual assault victims. They're just not emotionally able to elaborate on the witness stand. They usually break down and start crying.
Right, and that's exactly my point, is that to the extent that defense counsel asks questions that result in the child breaking down and crying, that's a very bad thing from defendant's perspective. So if the state is going to put in this tape, shouldn't the state be required to make an effort to get a more complete statement on the witness stand from the witness, as opposed to just saying, you know, did you give an interview? Was it, you know, do you remember so-and-so? Yeah, I do. Did you do it voluntarily? And was it truthful? All that. And what was it about? He did something bad to me. And at that point, the state says, fine, we've got everything we need. And then there's no, the state doesn't have to do any questioning of this witness about the actual facts. And what I'm asking is whether it isn't more appropriate, as Mr. Hurley suggested, for the state to have that obligation.
Well, the statute doesn't require it. I mean, that's what the legislature decided in 1970, was that they would permit these type of out-of-court statements. I think the original intent was for the turncoat witness, but it's been used, and the statute says you can use it whether it's consistent or inconsistent with the trial testimony. And I think the practical difficulty is just how much are you going to get from these child victims, 7, 8, 9-year-old victims. The attempt can certainly be made, but I don't know that there's a requirement or should be an additional requirement. We already have several decisional requirements that have been imposed on the introduction of 3507.
Let's touch on those. You outlined them earlier. I could conceive, following up on Justice Berger's concerns, that the phrase "touch on the events" is more than what was done in this particular case, and that the prosecution has no interest in touching on the events in a meaningful way, and having the witness, to use the vernacular, clam up or break down during direct examination. They can always hit the sweet spot by turning to the out-of-court statement from a non-courtroom environment where the witness is presumably under less pressure, the kind of pressure, by the way, that Anglo-American trials won't want witnesses under in order to be more credible in a process getting the truth from the witnesses. Couldn't you take just that phrase, touch on the events, and say it's got to be more than something bad happened to me, but if you really want to know what it is, hear about it on the tape I gave weeks ago in the comforts of the child advocacy bureaucracy, rather than here in a courtroom in front of the jury who's going to determine the fate of the defendant. The real issue is just how far should the state have to go in order to have credibly touched on the events that are going to be discussed in the out-of-court pretrial statement?
Well, that's a difficult line, I guess, to draw, and it's going to depend on the facts and circumstances of each case. But I think the effort needs to be made that you're trying to show that a crime occurred first, and then second, what was the nature of the crime. And then here,
in this particular case, do you agree that without the 3507 statement, the testimony on the witness stand would have been insufficient to support a conviction?
For first-degree rape? I don't know. She does say my private part, and then I guess you get into the argument as to whether or not that's sufficient for first-degree rape, or is it just, you know, a sexual assault of a lesser degree?
Well, I hope
not.
We haven't reached the point in this state where touching someone's private parts are rape, rather than offensive touching.
No, and I think that's the difficulty with what Justice Holland poses is if you just look at the testimony from the witness stand, I think that's what she says, my private part.
Well, my question is, if the state has the burden of proof, why shouldn't it have to make a good faith effort to establish the evidence from the witness stand? Getting in the 3507 statement by touching on the events is a separate consideration. But the way the law seems to have evolved is, since under 3507 the statement can come in as independent evidence of guilt, the state frequently stops when it could continue to make a good faith effort because it wants to get the evidence in through the statement. So I understand your answer to the other justices' questions about problems with witnesses, but those are all situations that can be dealt with when the problem arises. My question is, why isn't Mr. Hurley's suggestion that the state make a good faith effort to prove the elements of its case from the witness stand a proper idea?
Well, I don't know that it's an improper idea, and I think you can certainly make the effort. The difficulty is going to be is what happens when the effort doesn't succeed. Then you have to say, well, okay, we're drawing the line a little further back here. That was sufficient.
Well, as long as the reason we're asking you this question different ways is you keep going back to it's going to be difficult, what are you going to do? And we already know the answer to that. If you've touched upon it and it's difficult, the statement comes in.
Correct.
So that's not going to change. What the only thing that would change is the state has to make a good faith effort to prove its case to the extent it can. If it gets to the point where it's just a roadblock, we have all sorts of cases that are going to let the 3507 statement in. But the question is, why shouldn't they have to make the effort?
Well, I don't know that they shouldn't have to make the effort, that the state shouldn't. And, you know, if that's going to be the law going forward, fine, we can enunciate that standard. It can be an additional 3507 requirement. Everybody will be on notice, and then, you know, we'll deal with the next case after that. But the law so far for the last 40 years has been the foundational requirements, the voluntariness and the truthfulness, and those were met in this particular case. Turning to the fourth argument about the sufficiency, I think if you look at
I'm intrigued by that. Let's go back for a moment. Touching on the events was met in this particular case based on the current law, one of the foundational requirements. You just said that, right?
Yes.
If all she said in support of a rape charge was he touched my private parts, how does that touch on the real events we're talking about here, which is an accusation of rape as opposed to offensive conduct or offensive touching? Wouldn't you think, logically, the state would have to ask her more than that before they have touched on the events? Because the events here aren't just an unlawful touching. The events that are focused in this trial, whether or not a rape occurred. How does someone defend themselves against a rape charge in front of a jury where a jury can assess the credibility of the victim when they can just turn to a tape done weeks, days, months, whatever the timing the state wants, as the real evidence in the case? When the witness hasn't said, I'm not talking anymore, the witness hasn't said, I have amnesia, I can't remember anything, there's not been a showing of an inability to get more information about the events from the witness. The state just stopped.
Well, I think that's a recurring issue with 3507 statements, but the constitutional guarantee is the right to confront the witness and cross-examine them. And that's what the defendant has. After the tape is played, then that's when cross-examination commences after that. So everything's out there for the jury. The defendant knows exactly what the nature of the accusation is and can cross-examine the witness accordingly. There's no limitation on what the defense can do, and that's the constitutional guarantee here, that 3507 doesn't offend the confrontation rights of an accused in this particular instance. And what we're doing is really talking about how you present this type of evidence here. And what was done here is normally what's done in the cases, that you go as far as you can with the witness. You have to meet the foundational requirements that have been established by case law.
But let's play it out. What happens when the defense counsel is left with no opportunity to cross-examine at the time the pretrial statement's made, of course, but on the basis of what's said in the pretrial statement, defense counsel says to this child witness, now, you've said here on the stand that he touched your private parts, yet you say in your pretrial statement that he touched you in a particular place which the state argues is consistent with rape. When were you telling the truth? Today on the stand when you limited it to simply touching your private part, or in your out-of-court statement to which you were not sworn in all probability? The witness is going to do what? At that point, the jury is going to hate defense counsel for doing his or her job, and the witness is going to break down crying and not say another word. Now, how does anyone in their right mind consider that a right to confront a witness under constitutional principles that's any form of effective cross-examination?
Well, I think you can certainly ask, however the evidence comes in, whether it's a 35 or 7 statement or direct testimony, you can certainly ask questions about that. Whether you want to characterize as some statement has not been as fully developed or less than candid as it should be, that's a subjective judgment you have to make. And I don't think I would do that as defense counsel. I think it's going to lead to the problems that have been illustrated here. I think what you do is you ask questions about what's in front of you. And what's done here, as you can see on the tape, is there's actually a little chart, and Diane Klecken is pointing to body parts, and she points to the vagina and asks the complaining witness what she calls that, and she says, I think it's the Spanish word, vagina. So when you have that sum total of that evidence, that's what's before the jury here, and that's the evidence that it's a first-degree rape charge and not some sort of offensive touching.
Mr. Williams, at least 3 of the foundational requirements for the Section 3507 statement don't seem to be at odds generally with the foundational requirements for other types of statements. That is, did you give the statement? Yes. Was it voluntarily? Yes. Was the statement truthful? Yes. Or no, whatever. But the statute goes further and requires, with this language that doesn't seem to have any antecedent anywhere, that the foundational testimony touch on the events. What's the content of that? That is to say, as a principled matter, what is the irreducible minimum that the state would have to do in order to satisfy that requirement?
Well, I don't know. That's been a puzzlement ever since, I guess, the Keyes decision. I think it came out shortly, I think it was like 5 years afterwards, but that's been the problem for at least the last 35 or 36 years, is what does touch upon mean? And I think at a minimum it means that you're describing an event that's a crime, and then two, you indicate the essentials, who the perpetrator was, who the victim was, those type of things.
Well, I mean, there are, and again, I'm speaking theoretically, you could have a range of options. At one extreme end would be that essentially you've got to recapitulate most of the substance of the testimony in order to get the statement in. That is, you would have to recapitulate most of the substance of what's in the statement already. The other, on the opposite end, would be that the testimony of the child simply has to allude in some vague sort of way to something bad that happened. And the state seems to be pushing much more in that direction than in the other. I understand that we may have had this problem for 35 years or whatever, but does the state have a principled position that can be articulated in an opinion of this court as to what it should have to do in order to satisfy that requirement?
Well, I think, touch upon the events, meaning whatever the events were that led to this accusation, And I think there has to be an identity of the parties, the complaining witness and the perpetrator, and such that it's at least apparent that some type of criminal activity has occurred. I think that's the touching upon the events, that those would be minimal requirements.
The child would have to identify the defendant, and the testimony would have to at least be probative of some criminal activity? Is that what
you're
saying?
Yes, I think you have to, you know, identify who the accused is, who you're talking about did these things, and that, you know, you're the alleged victim, and then what occurred.
Then you get back to the Chief Justice's question. In this particular case, the criminal activity may be enough if the charge were offensive touching, but this is a rape charge.
Right.
So doesn't it have to be the criminal activity that's the subject of the indictment?
Well, I guess the question then is going to be, how far do you have to go? And some of these crimes are several different elements here. The only real disputed element, I guess, in this case, because there was talking about age, is the type of sexual contact that occurred.
Mr. Williams, I want to ask you about a couple of other issues. I see your time is almost up. The administrative directive about interpreters came as a result of a task force report studying issues of racial and ethnic fairness in the courts. One of the things the report indicated is that sometimes interpreters were taking liberties with the interpretation. So we have the administrative directive that requires the interpreter to be sworn. If every other witness in the trial has to give sworn testimony, why is it so insignificant that the interpreter who's giving the testimony as far as the jury is concerned through the translation was not sworn or doesn't have to be sworn?
Well, I don't think it was insignificant. I think certainly the trial judge didn't follow Administrative Directive 107 in two respects. One, he didn't swear the interpreter, and two, he didn't give an instruction to the jury later on about the role of the interpreter. The question here, though, is, okay, that's what happened, but there wasn't any defense objection. Is it plain error or not? And there's no indication in this particular case that there was a mistranslation. The defendant elected not to testify, so there wasn't an indication that, or no basis for an indication that his ability to understand or not understand English would prejudice him in any way. It's not like the Diaz case where we had the bilingual juror who
I'm familiar with Diaz. Well, in this case, let's suppose another witness wasn't sworn. Would your position be the same? You know, it doesn't really matter that the witness wasn't sworn.
Well, I guess it depends on what the witness said. I don't know.
Well, in this particular case, the interpreter translated the testimony that supported the elements of the crime that resulted in the conviction, didn't they?
I don't know if they did or not. If you look at this interview, there's not an interpreter at the interview, and she the complaining witness lays out all the elements in the interview, and an interpreter's not present there, and that's just played for the jury. You know, the case itself really came in through the complaining witness. She testified about the events. There were no other eyewitnesses to this crime. It was simply complaining witness and the defendant. And the defendant elected not to testify. His defense was a fabrication defense presented by other witnesses.
The last question I wanted to ask you about was the mistrial issue. Just tell me succinctly your position with regard to that.
Well, I think in this particular case that the mistrial wasn't necessary, that if you look at the normal four factors here, and the focus has been on the statement of the mother, here that it wasn't repeated, it wasn't in response to any prosecution questioning, it was a defense cross-examination question near the end of the day. The defense simply made a strategic decision not to request a curative instruction. You know, they didn't indicate that at the day that it happened, that they simply moved for a mistrial at that time. That's at B-25.
Well, where on the continuum do we draw the line there? What if this was a retrial and the witness said, and he's been convicted before of this very crime? Would that be something that could be cured?
Well, I don't know. That's pretty extreme. I suspect at that point, as reluctant as trial judges are, especially if it's a retrial and it's a long trial, you'd probably get a mistrial declared at that point.
Exactly what happened in one of the Bailey cases. After that happened on the witness stand, the Superior Court judge said from the bench, that's it.
Yes.
He stopped the trial, declared a mistrial.
Yes, and I've been in a case where that's happened. It wasn't a retrial. It was somebody blurted something out that was just totally inappropriate, and the judge stopped it then, and it was like the third or fourth day. But that happens sometimes.
But I don't understand the waiver argument, because if the defense asks for a mistrial and takes the position that this is not something that can be cured by an instruction, that the only remedy is a mistrial, why isn't that a position the defense could take without turning it into a waiver?
Oh, I think they can. I don't mean to confuse the court. The waiver is only about requesting the curative instruction. I think that's the fourth element about what could the court have done as a remedial matter at that point. That's the only waiver part.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
I don't know. I've never been in any of your positions, and obviously never will. I don't know if you ask questions because you really want to know the answers or you want to see if I know the answer. So I'm going to assume that Justice Berger's question was to gather information rather than to see if I know what I'm talking about. With regard to your question about whether or not there was a request for a mistrial at the end of the day before the jury went out, what happened at pages 98 and 99 of the A transcript is the question had been asked by the defense counsel, and the remark had come out, and with not just my daughter but also my niece, and then there's eight lines, and then there's a sidebar, and the trial counsel then says at sidebar, there was evidence about the prior conviction, and the prosecutor says, we talked about it, there's a language barrier, we're doing what we can. Trial counsel says, I don't see how my question opened the door to that answer. The court will get to that when we don't have the jury sitting here in front of us. And then the court attends to whether or not the indictment was properly drafted and whether or not there's been further discussions about the guilty plea, releases the jury at 4:40. And the next day, the trial judge, in talking about whether a curative instruction should be given at that point, says, quote, at B14, I'm not saying that if the Supreme Court decided that was too close, that I could say, gee, I'm upset that I made the wrong call. I think it is concerning. And that's a day later. So very obviously, as I had said, the building was on fire the day before. The state and I do agree about one thing, and that is, and it was one word that sort of slipped out of Mr. Williams' mouth, he said that what the state would have to prove is the identity of the perpetrator and the essentials, a.k.a. elements, of rape. He didn't say rape. And I think we're in agreement. That's what there has to be a good faith attempt to prove, the elements, the essentials of the case. With regard to the interpreter situation, a key state's witness, Sylvia, everything was interpreted. And although the state says, well, you know, you can't prove prejudice, I got some folks back there that their relative is facing, 40 years in prison? And here's the state say, well, yeah, okay. Oh, didn't happen. I don't think that's good enough. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.